Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Observatory, straight up the block to West Boulevard and make that right.
They didn't break that, but they have pretty good access to those people.
Yeah, she subconsciously mocks that lineage. But
so that's happening.
It seems like an incredible story here on many fronts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. And now, let's talk a little about Bitcoin.
It's the middle of the lunch rush at Mezza Grill in Midtown Manhattan.
Yes.
Cold, hard cash is being exchanged.
There you go. 80 cents is your change.
But so is a virtual kind of currency called Bitcoin.
Dennis, I don't know if you've been reading the papers lately. There's something called Bitcoin. I'm not sure.
Every Bitcoin bull that you speak to says the
scarcity. A lot of people talk about Bitcoin as a new kind of currency, but ignore that part.
Bitcoin
is a crappy currency.
Dollars. Bitcoin.
I just got some Bitcoin. Have you heard about Bitcoin? It's the currency of the future.
I know a guy who invested in Bitcoin 5 years ago, and he made like $100 million.
Bitcoin are kind of like cash, but if cash were on the computer as Bitcoin.
Hey, roll down your window. Want to buy some Bitcoin? You a cop?
Honey, there's something I need to tell you. I'm a Bitcoin.
Our farm to Bitcoin menu includes a free-range Bitcoin, smoked on a cedar Bitcoin, and served with an emulsion of Bitcoin-infused Bitcoin on a bed of Bitcoin. Okay, so can I start anybody off with some wine?
Daddy, Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency.
Unleash your wild side. 8 sexy, sensual ways to please your Bitcoin in bed.
Heat the olive oil over medium heat. When it begins to shimmer, add the shallots, stirring frequently until they are translucent. Remove and place on a paper towel to Bitcoin.
Funny, she doesn't look Bitcoin.
Isn't it rich? Are we a Bitcoin? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair. Send in the clowns.
What Conversations About Bitcoin Sound Like to Me by Ethan Cooperberg. Cooperberg is a longtime contributor to The New Yorker's Shouts and Murmurs and a writer on Transparent. Next week on the show, we're going to go on a trip with Ian Frazier to visit three guys in Colorado. They're friends, they're roommates, and top competitors in the wonderful world of professional drone racing. It's really a thing, and I can't think of anybody better than Ian Frazier to tell us about it. I hope you'll join us for that. For 20 years now, Elizabeth Colbert has been writing about science and the environment for The New Yorker. And her book, The Sixth Extinction, won the Pulitzer Prize. Recently, Colbert wrote about the Interior Department under Ryan Zinke, the cabinet secretary in charge of federal lands throughout the United States. Zinke is one of the keys to Donald Trump's goal of deregulating the environment. Case in point, the recent decision to shrink Bears Ears National Monument in Utah. A decision which opened much of that land to uranium mining. Here's Elizabeth Colbert.
Now, Zinke is a former congressman from Montana. He was a Navy SEAL, which is important part of his background because he seems to want to run things in a sort of military-style fashion. He then became a state lawmaker from Montana, and then he was a one-term congressman from Montana.
He was a one-term congressman from Montana, but what kind of legislator was he? What was the emphasis of his brief work in Washington as a congressman?
Well, it's actually kind of an interesting tenure, you know, in the House of Representatives. He was considered sort of a moderate on public lands issues, opposing some of the more kind of, I'm going to call them radical steps that some congressmen like a bishop from Utah were recommending of just basically handing over these enormous tracts of federal lands to the states, which is what a lot of people on the far right, I guess, are advocating. He pushed back. He's from Montana, which is a big state for, you know, tourism and sportsmen, and got, I think, chastised for that and has now really fallen into line with this program of the Trump administration, which is basically just giving away as much public land as possible.
If you add up his recommendations, they're extremely alarming. He proposed increasing offshore drilling. He recommended opening up millions of protected acres for mining. He recommended slashing several national monuments. And by monuments, we mean enormous tracts of land in some of the most beautiful parts of the country. And he overturned a moratorium on new leases for coal mines. Which of these changes are being implemented right away, and which are still policy proposals under review and debate?
Well, none of them in effect, or very few of them, can go into effect immediately, because in most of these cases, I think that they're going to get stalled in court, but they, you know, started very early. One of the things I will just mention, that this has taken effect, I believe. You know, one of the first things Zinke did, the Obama administration had put in place this program to try to eliminate plastic water bottles from national parks because they produce a lot of trash. They're just, you know, not environmentally sound. And there was a report produced largely under the Obama administration that had been very successful. It saved a lot of trash, saved a lot of energy, that sort of thing. And one of the first things that the Trump administration did under, you know, pressure from the bottled water industry was to lift that ban. So
that seems almost perverse, almost gratuitous to reallow plastic bottles to be all over the place in national parks. I mean, really, even in the most cynical sense, how does the administration, does Donald Trump benefit from that?
You know, I think someone who's very cynical would say, you know, look at where, you know, Dannon or Poland Springs or whatever is giving their money. And I wouldn't be surprised if you find, you know, transfer, you know, campaign contributions. But is that really, you know, enough money to sway an administration, awash in, you know, Koch brother money and Mercer family money? I don't know, but there's really no other reason except, as you say, either perversity, or you're, you know, in the pocket of the soft drink industry.
Let me read you something from Secretary Zinke's biography on the Department of Interior website. It says, Zinke is widely praised for his voting record supporting the Teddy Roosevelt philosophy of managing public lands, which calls for multiple use to include economic recreation and conservation. Unquote. Now, we think of Teddy Roosevelt as somebody who started establishing national parks throughout the country. We think of him, despite his killing of all kinds of wildlife in his time, as somebody deeply interested in nature and its preservation. Again, very much a man of his time. What does Secretary Zinke mean by the Teddy Roosevelt philosophy? What does that philosophy look like in practice?
Well, he's always invoked Teddy Roosevelt, and he continues to invoke Teddy Roosevelt. And as I mentioned early on in his career, you know, he had some, you know, perhaps always debatable claim to be trying to, you know, walk that line between preserving public lands for, you know, sportsmen and for wildlife and using them for commercial interests. And now, though, he seems to have gone, you know, totally into the all exploitation all the time mode, and many groups have, you know, started to make, you know, actively make fun of his claims to be a latter day Teddy Roosevelt, and he's very folksy and sort of outdoorsy claims to be. Although I recently read another piece by someone who had been fishing with him and noticed that his, you know, tackle was upside down, and Zinke didn't seem to notice that. So how much of a real outdoorsman he is, I guess, is questionable.
Well, the cultural shift is also noticeable in other ways. You write that Secretary Zinke had the arcade game Big Buck Hunter installed in the cafeteria of the Department of Interior. Tell me about that.
I mean, it's a kind of ridiculous-looking game. He tweeted this photo of himself standing next to it, which it was, you know, sort of many people thought sort of comical. But, you know, this is part of this, you know, weird, some would say rather bizarre, lame symbolism. For example, he is well known in D.C. when the secretary is in the Interior Department's offices on C Street, they raise a flag to indicate that he is there.
Like the Queen at Buckingham Palace.
Yes, but apparently it is some sort of military tradition. I guess maybe if the commander's on the post, you raise a flag. I'm not a military person, so I don't know, but it has military roots. But it's been looked at as kind of ridiculous.
There's another big change going on, and that's got to do with the idea of climate change and the way it's addressed by the Department of the Interior and also the EPA. How does this compare with what we've seen in the past?
Well, yes, that's you know, a huge and alarming, it couldn't be more alarming change. And it really gets to the Orwellian nature of this administration. They've just eliminated a lot of discussion, you know, on their websites and in federal reports. For example, they put out a strategic report for the Interior Department for 5 years that did not mention climate change. People are being actively discouraged from discussing climate change.
Is that merely for short-term business interests? Is that what's ruling the day here, this kind of cognitive sense that we don't believe what science and scientists are telling us? Is it all for money, campaign contributions?
Well, I think that you can't be too cynical here, unfortunately. And my sense, my belief is that this is, and this gets to the idea that once you put a rig in, once you lease that land offshore, you know, you can't take it back, is that they're trying to, and the oil and gas industry and coal industry is trying to, you know, sort of like, let's stake out as much as we possibly can during this administration, because we know this party is over. We know that fossil fuels, you know, are not the fuels of the future. But let's try to grab as much as we can right now. Let's try to put as much infrastructure in as we can right now. And that's a really scary thing, because once you put in a pipeline, you know, once you put in a coal-fired power plant, there's tremendous inertia in the system to amortize that investment. And that is exactly what we don't want to be doing. We do not want to be putting any more fossil fuel infrastructure in. We need to be shifting really dramatically in the other direction. And so this is this huge play, I think, last play, you know, of this long fossil fuel binge. And it's going to really set us back. And 10, 20, 30 years from now, not very long from now, you know, we're going to look back on this as a really, really crucial, you know, decade that we're losing and cannot afford to lose.
So what's happening here is, as they say in the Middle East, they're creating facts on the ground.
Exactly.
Finally, Betsy, you write in your really eviscerating piece on Ryan Zinke and the present Department of the Interior, in the decades to come, one can hope that many of the Trump administration's mistakes on tax policy, say, or trade, will be rectified. But the destruction of the country's last unspoiled places is a loss that can never be reversed. What checks are there on Zinke's authority? What hope is there of reversing any of these measures, either in the courts or through advocacy or through future political action?
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of them, the majority of them, will be challenged in the courts and hopefully stayed in the courts. But that, you know, that gets us into a whole other conversation about, you know, what they're doing to the courts. But let us hope, you know, for the moment that some of these district courts will, you know, these cases will actually drag on. That is really the best that we can hope for at this point, because I do think that the plan is, and their hope is, to get as much in the ground as possible, as you said, facts on the ground. And that piece that I wrote quoted someone who had been in the Interior Department in the Obama administration, who said, you know, they know exactly what they're doing, and they know that once you muck up these places, there's no longer any reason to preserve them. So that is the really frightening part of it.
Elizabeth Culbert, thank you.
Thanks, David.
Elizabeth Culbert, staff writer at The New Yorker. You can find her reporting on the Department of the Interior and much else at NewYorker.com. Now, along with the treatment of animals, the environment is a chief reason why some of us become vegetarian, about 3% of Americans at this point. And the environmental statistics are pretty damning. There's the consumption of food crops by animals, the drain on water supplies, the overuse of antibiotics, pollution, and the list goes on. In the food business, there's competition to create vegetarian substitutes that taste a little bit better than, well, you know, seitan and all that stuff, and that could maybe one day become viable alternatives to meat. Shauna Lyon, who edits the New Yorker's food and drink page, has been exploring the options.
I used to be a vegetarian. I was a vegetarian for 15 years. At that time, I ate a lot of veggie burgers. They were the kind that were out of a box. They were frozen. They were dry and sad and gray. And, you know, you could dress them up, but they never tasted good. So I'm not a vegetarian anymore, and I do eat burgers. But then I heard about a new kind of veggie burger called the Impossible Burger, which is a veggie burger that looks a lot like a meat burger. And they said tastes a lot like a meat burger. It also bleeds like a meat burger. And I was really curious. I really wanted to try it. So we went to an Umami Burger, which is a burger chain.
Pretty good. I'm Melvin. I've been taking care of you guys today.
Hey, Melvin.
They are known for having beef burgers that are hyper-powered with some kind of umami, which is like a savory flavor. And so it was interesting that they were carrying the Impossible Burger. That was a seal of approval. Like, this really tastes like meat.
You're in for a treat. Have you had them?
I haven't yet.
Oh, yeah. I've had many.
You have? Okay. Oh, yeah.
So I brought along this expert on plant-based meat. Bruce Friedrich founded and runs the Good Food Institute.
Veggie burgers were pretty bad up until maybe 15 years ago. And
Boca's good. And yeah. Morningstar.
All of them are getting better and better. I mean, they're all
up their game a little. Yeah.
And it's a very exciting thing to see. People in plant-based say, like, why limit yourself to animal cells? With plant-based meat, we can replicate what people like, and we can do even better.
When you say you can do even better, you mean you can make it taste better?
Yeah, and animal-based burgers are not going to get better, but plant-based burgers will.
So maybe the Impossible Burger won't make you swear off meat forever, but maybe it'll make you eat a little less meat. And Bruce thinks that would be great.
One of the sort of obvious but underappreciated facts is that if one person goes vegetarian, that is the same as two people cutting back by half, but it's probably going to be a lot easier to get two people to cut back by half than to get one person to go completely vegetarian. Hey.
I have two Impossible Burgers for you guys.
Thank you very
much.
You're welcome, guys. Enjoy.
So we got our Impossible Burger. It's pretty big. Two patties smothered in cheese. They look a lot like meat. The Impossible Burger looks like, it doesn't look like those fat, juicy burgers. It looks like a couple of smashed patties, like very thin, but also charred on the edges, which, you know, that makes a good burger too. And you know, there's a flag stuck right in the middle that says Impossible Burger. The Impossible Burger is not really that different from a lot of other veggie burgers. It's made of wheat protein and coconut oil and potato protein. But the thing that makes it different from other veggie burgers is heme. It's an iron-containing compound found in blood, which is what gives meat that iron flavor. And Impossible Burger found a way to take heme from plants and make more of it using fermentation. Heme is one of the things that makes beef burgers really satisfying. Why do you think it's so hard for people to imagine giving up meat?
I've spent like 30 years pondering that question. I adopted a vegan diet in 1987, and the arguments were just so clear to me, and I thought they would be clear to everybody else. And I thought, nobody loves meat more than I do. Nobody eats more meat than I do. If I can do this, anybody can do this. And I've certainly convinced a fair number of people to cut back or cut out, but the vast majority of people, they're just too busy leading their lives. The cacophony of life makes it really hard to make, you know, to, like, you've been doing something for 20 or 50 or 70 years, and it's just like what you do, and suddenly somebody's saying, no, you should do something different. That's a pretty big ask.
I wonder if the Impossible Burger does taste like a real burger.
I'm looking forward to hearing what you think.
Okay, here we go. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it has the same consistency and texture as a regular burger. The flavor is a little bit bland, missing a little bit of the that deep, like, iron flavor that you get, like the...
That's the heme, actually.
It needs some more heme.
I don't know.
I totally feel like I'm eating a burger. And I think I can enjoy it more than a beef burger. Definitely more than a turkey burger. Turkey burgers are terrible.
Aw. Thank you. I mean, so a historical flashback. The year is 1898.
Okay.
There are 175,000 horses out here on the streets of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
They are laying down 50,000 tons of manure every single month.
Ooh.
There are horse carcasses everywhere. And the world's first urban planning conference was convened here in New York City. And it was supposed to last a couple weeks. And after a couple of days, they decided there just is no solution. Everybody just went home. And 10 years later, 1908, Henry Ford introduces the Model T. And by 1912, there are more cars than horses on the streets of New York City. I'm absolutely convinced that that's what plant-based meat and clean meat represent. Because industrial animal agriculture, I mean, it is going to bring on climate catastrophe. It could be the end of working antibiotics. Like, these are really big problems. And plant-based meat and clean meat can replicate animal-based meat, completely displace it, because it's a better product.
But I think I'm not so sure about Bruce's analogy. Cars did not save the environment. In fact, they caused a lot of other problems. I'm also not sure eating plant-based meat will fix all the problems that Bruce was talking about. But if eating veggie burgers that taste like meat can help, and they're delicious, why not?
Shauna Lyon edits Goings On About Town in The New Yorker and our food and drink page. I'm David Remnick, and that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you'll join us next time. Till then, follow us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.